finally welcome you to into my podcast, Musikleben. I have studied classical singing and voice, and I love to sing contemporary music. And if you would like to know more about me, please look at my website, www.irenekurka.de, and I put this for you into the show notes. And if you would like to know more about me, please subscribe to my monthly newsletter. In this podcast, I talk about themes all around contemporary music and whatever is related with it. I share with you the behind the scenes, the insider knowledge, and I bring you the human beings out of this music world closer. And this is what I love the most. I'm cooperating with the NMZ, Neue Musikzeitung, one of the most important German-speaking music papers. In this episode, I have an interview for you with Jeffrey Gordon. Jeffrey Gordon is a composer, and he will have a premiere, Titus, on the 27th of March in 2026 with WDR Symphony Orchestra. So let's dive into the interview with Jeffrey Gordon.
Hello, Jeffrey Gordon. I cordially welcome you into my podcast, Neue Musikleben, and I'm so glad that we got together today.
Irena, I am thrilled to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
And I'm so excited because you're on the other side of the world and you have a very
I am technically on the other side of the world. That is true. It's hard to say where I am at any given moment, but at this moment, I am on the other side of the world and it is wickedly cold here.
It's very cold in Germany right now, too, but I know it's even colder in the United States.
I think right now it's about 20 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. Dangerously cold, which
so
I love.
So you don't go out?
I do. I love winter. I prefer winter. And so I'm very, very happy. And I'm here writing in northern Wisconsin in the United States for a short time. And it's the perfect place for me.
Awesome. Well, we're going to talk about this piece you're going to premiere with the WDR Orchestra in
March.
It's in March, right?
March, I believe.
In March.
You're challenging me because I'm less likely to remember the date than you are, just simply because there's so much going on. But I'm pretty sure it's the end of March.
Yes, I think it is the end of March. And we're going to.
And despite my poor memory,
this
I'm
interview
very much
in the early March. So.
Good.
So before we're going to talk about this new piece, I would like to know from you, how did you find your way into this new and experimental music?
Wow, how much time do we have? So the usual story, and this is not the first time I've told this, but the usual story is that I started playing in rock and roll bands in Detroit, Michigan in the United States when I was a teenager, and I sort of fell in love with the Beatles and with electric guitar and spent a lot of time playing that music really into my early 20s. But I had an epiphany and a sort of sudden realization that I also really loved opera, which made me unusual in my circle of friends. But through voice study and listening, I started to realize that I had more in common intellectually with classical music than I did with rock and roll, which perfectly legitimate art form, but felt limiting in so many ways, architecturally, harmonically, in terms of the scope of what you could do. And, you know, 3 minutes is great. And there's some 3 minute masterpieces that have been written for sure. But I just found myself slowly morphing and through singing and through becoming really acquainted with really 17th and 18th century opera, first of all, and then sort of drifting into the 19th century and realizing I was much more at home in that world. Also not as likely to be struck while performing or having anyone throw a beer at you, which I liked. And so I just sort of slowly became more intrigued and started. And I always wrote songs. Even in the early days, I wrote songs. And I think it was a natural progression to sort of wind through that path into where I am now. I don't so much think of, you know, I know you use the word experimental and new music and all of that. And I try to remind myself every day that it's the same 12 notes that Brahms used, you know, it's the same 12 notes that Lennon and McCartney used. It's, and so the language may be different, but I really, and I know we're going to maybe get into this later. I try to stay out of that new music box because that's limiting too, in a way. And it also, I mean, it can be off-putting, I think. And we want to attract people to this art form. So I just think of it as music, you know, really.
Yeah, I can feel you because actually one of the reasons I started this podcast was also to bring this music out of the box because I'm like, we're doing such great music and I don't want to be in a box.
No, I don't either. I don't either. And you know, well, so when I was reviewing, thinking through the things we might talk about, I have a recording coming out sometime next year, which I can't go into the details that haven't been announced yet, but it will involve some of my chamber music and some Brahms on the same disc. And for me, I loved that because I think in order to take new music seriously and in order to spread the word, we can't be in this new music ghetto all the time where we're only on discs with other new music, where we're excluded from being side by side with Brahms and Mozart and Beethoven and Britain, even. I mean, at this point, can you call Britain new music? It's 100 years old. I think it's really important to be accepted into the same corridors as what is euphemistically thought of as classical music. It is classical music. It's granted, it was written a year ago or whatever, but so what? You know, the Brahms clarinet quintet was new once too, but it wasn't like it was thought of as needing to exist in its own room. And I think that's really important. It's important for players. It's important for the audience. It's important for us to embrace the music simply as notes on a page, logic, architecture, melody, harmony. We're still doing the same things. And I think it's really important. And I was really pleased to know that a work of mine will be on this disc with some Brahms and that they'll be there side by side. That's the way it should be. And if you can't stand up to that comparison, you're in the wrong field.
And I mean, obviously you had this desire, or it's so natural to you all along, because I mean, your pieces are played all over the place, all over the world, and by many orchestras, like regular symphonic orchestras. Mm-hmm. And so I also assume that they combine it with other pieces, so you are already at this place that the regular concert listener listens to your music. So you already made the step, I guess, out of this new music ghetto.
Very, very kind of you to point that out. One of my favorite things in the course of my year is when I find out that, you know, a work has been programmed, as you say, by what let's call them mainstream orchestras. My favorite thing is looking at the program. Sometimes I have some influence over that, but most of the time I don't, quite honestly. Most of the time it's programmed with whatever the conductor or the soloists involved, whatever the sort of theme of an orchestra season might be. But I love seeing where my piece lands on a program with Ravel or Debussy or Shostakovich or Stravinsky or Mozart or anybody. I think it's my favorite thing because just for the reason that we were discussing, it gives you, it's both a challenge and a reward. The reward is that you've done this work and it stands up to that. And the people who are programming your works have decided you can stand next to Mahler and, you know, the sun will come up the next day. And so there's that, but it's also a challenge because particularly when it's a new piece, the piece that premieres in Germany, in Cologne in March that we're talking about later, that's the premiere, that's the world premiere of that piece. So it's a challenge for me because the other pieces on that program, everybody's going to know them. They've all been played many, many times. So you are, in a way, you're at a kind of sonic disadvantage in that sense because nobody doesn't. I mean, literally no one but me has heard this piece so far, right? In my head, that's it. So when the lights go down at the end of March and it's, I'm forgetting, but I think there's some Saint-Saëns on that program. I honestly, I don't remember what else is on it, but whatever it is, chances are someone in the audience has already heard it and they will not have heard mine. So that is a challenge. It's also, I'm also grateful to the audience because it takes a willing audience to listen, and we need them.
When you mentioned your way into your composing, and you mentioned that you were into opera and singing. So did you sing a lot, or can I imagine this?
I did. I had a brief, not particularly distinguished opera career, but I did perform, absolutely. And there was a period of time right out of university where I had to make a decision. I was trying to write and also sort of nurture a singing career. And there was a point at which that became unworkable. They're both really demanding endeavors. And for me, I miss singing. I loved singing. I love the physical feeling of singing well. There's, you know, people talk about the endorphins you get from running or whatever. There's an endorphin rush from really healthy vocal production. When you sing well and you feel that in your, and the resonance is in your head and you feel you're on your breath and it rides and it's a wonderful feeling. I loved it. And I loved rehearsing. I loved working with a pianist and having those moments together. And so it was very difficult to give that up, quite honestly. I miss it. I physically miss it. But I know I made the right choice.
Mm-hmm. Well, I find that so interesting because then I know that you write then well for voice because you really feel us. You feel me as a singer. And I think then you also have having played in a band before, you have a feeling for the performers, how they feel, how they, you know, have to deal with the challenges you give them. And so what are the qualities you like most in performers you worked with?
Wow. Well, first of all, you know, I am aware that every time anyone agrees to play something of mine, it's privileged for me. Gosh, there's a lot of music out there, right? I mean, we're talking about 400 years, conservatively 400 years of repertoire that can be chosen. So I am always unbelievably grateful when I find out somebody is playing or singing something of mine. That's like the first thing. And in terms of qualities, I mean, what you really want, you know, you really want a colleague. You know, I can tell you what I don't like. What I don't like is no feedback, no communication. I've had a few, they're few and far between, but I've had them where you really don't have much communication. And I usually try, and sometimes you don't get a lot of feedback and you don't get a lot of interaction. I always think, what a missed opportunity, not because it's me, but what a missed opportunity for the performer. You know, you can't ask Mozart what he meant. You know, you can't ask Stravinsky what he meant. You can ask me. I mean, you can ask me what I meant. You can say, why did you do this? I don't like this, or I wish it was this way. And I'm happy to hear that. And I always say to people, you know, if there's something that you don't like, tell me. I can't promise I'll change it, but I might. And I need to learn too, right? So every time somebody plays something of mine, if we talk, I learn something. And then the next piece is better. So I just had a premiere with Cleveland Orchestra a few months ago. And that really was one of the really great experiences I've had in a while, where I was in constant contact with the soloist Robert Walters, who gave the U.S. premiere of my English Horn Concerto Mad Song, Tugan Sokiev and the Cleveland Orchestra, and three performances and lots of rehearsal. And really, for a composer, it's just a dream to be in that environment with one of the really great orchestras in the world, and everybody is pitching in. And Robert Walters was so committed to that piece, and you know, he set the bar really high. but I've had, you know, I have absolutely been really, really lucky. Loads and loads of great colleagues. And I think the other thing is, you know, the truth of the matter is, almost every performer that you work with wants to talk to you because you are live. And if you're now, if you're a new music specialist, maybe that phenomenon becomes routine. But if you're not, you know, then it's a cool change that you're suddenly talking to someone who wrote the piece that's on your music stand. you know? And so I think it's a, if you don't do that, it's a missed opportunity.
Yeah, I like it too. I can talk to you composers.
Mm-hmm.
Since I also have listeners who are young composers, or maybe even studying or getting started their career as well, and I sometimes hear that they find it hard to work with an orchestra or really bring their ideas through when they have to whatever talk about it in rehearsal to be clear, because sometimes maybe it feels intimidating. There are all those professional musicians. And sometimes, at least in Germany, they also have been little troubles that maybe some orchestra players were not so happy with whatever the composer has written. Do you have any advice, or what is a good approach to get this crowd on your side?
That's really important. What you said there at the end, you really do want everyone on your side. That is really important. I mean, honestly, if you lose the orchestra, that's a tough road. There's so much to say about this. You know, the first thing I would say is, if you know a little bit about music history, you know, read how Tchaikovsky's first piano concerto was received. Read how Tchaikovsky's his violin concerto was received. It was a nightmare. You know, he was told it couldn't be played, and people didn't want to play it. And now, of course, it's routine. So my first suggestion is have confidence. Have confidence in what you've done. It is an intimidating environment. Of course it is, especially if it's your first time. And the truth is, in most orchestra environments, there are very few rehearsals. And so much needs to be done in such a short period of time that there isn't usually a lot of extra time for chit-chat. My first suggestion is make sure your scores are really clear. Make sure your parts are right. Make sure that you know what you mean. So, you know, it's a little bit like, so there used to be a TV program here in the States called Wild Kingdom about the natural world. And, you know, big things eat small things. And that's how nature works. Don't be the small thing in the room, because the big thing in the room will eat you. You have to be confident, and you have to stand up for yourself, but you have to do it obviously in a respectful way. And you have to make your points quick and clear, and there have to be very few of them. Simply, and not because people don't want to work with you, but usually it's because they just don't have time. So my advice is, be confident, but realize that the work that you do in your room by yourself, and how well you do that, and how clearly you do that, will determine the success or failure when it hits the music stands and the reeds and the bows and the baton are suddenly active. You can't fix things then that you got wrong before. There just isn't time. And the other thing, quite honestly, and you said it, you know, it's not just Germany, I assure you. Listen, not everyone's going to love what you do. You know, not everyone's going to fall in love the first day that they hear it. And maybe after they've played it, they'll feel differently. There might be some resistance. You have to have armor against that. You cannot be fragile. You cannot fall apart. And you can fall apart inside, but on the outside, you can't fall apart outside. So, you know, and listen, and also there's a learning curve. So be kind to yourself. The first time might not be perfect. Just like with every other aspect of music, repetition is what leads to perfection. You just have to get in there and keep doing it.
Wow. Very, very valuable. So in March, you're going to work with the WDR Orchestra. Is this your first time with them?
It is. It is.
Woo!
Yes. Yes. Very excited. What a fabulous orchestra, too, as I'm sure you know.
Yeah, certainly. Certainly. And you have a piece that is called Titus. It sounds
Itis
Latin
Andronic.
And has to do with Shakespeare. And
yes.
What can you already tell us about this piece? I mean, you sent me the score even, I read some of the texts, and what is this piece about?
Well, so if you've looked at my catalog, not all, but a lot of my work originates in some way with literature or the arts, visual arts, poetry. You know, one of the great privileges of being a composer is you get to spend time working with these great works of art from other eras, or they could be current things as well. And so I do love Shakespeare, and this piece really originated. I wrote a cello sonata inspired by The Tempest called Fathoms. And that piece was structured very similarly to the way Titus is structured, which is to say, he sort of walks through specific quotes taken from the play, which are the subtitles of the movements of the work. And so I knew that I wanted to do something with Titus Andronicus. I don't know how well you or your listeners are familiar with this play, but it's shocking, even by today's standards, the violence, the blood, I think, I'm trying to think of a parallel. You know, this is a piece that was written, the play was written in 1587, 88, something like that. And it reads as fresh and shocking now as it must have been then. I can't imagine how it was received then. So I was always drawn to this. There's a Julie Taymor film about this with Anthony Hopkins, the actor. It's visually stunning and shocking as well. And so I've always had that in my head, and I really wanted to address it in some way. And when we started talking about this piece, about working together, I really wanted to take the plunge and write this tone poem, which is a prelude in five acts, five movements, with these text references that sort of walk this tone poem through the play. And that's what it is.
Beautiful. People should go.
I hope they do. I hope they do. And I think, you know, you don't have to read the play. You don't have to know the play to appreciate the music. It would be cool to read the quotes, and I'm sure they'll be in the program guide. And it is helpful to know. But, you know, the beauty of music, obviously, is that the music should have an emotional resonance with you, whether you know the play or not. I mean, the music was generated from me, and as the result of my love of this play and the power and the stunning nature of this play. But the music should resonate with you, whether you know it or not. You certainly don't need to know the play to appreciate the piece, I hope.
Yeah, great, great. And I mean, I already heard a little bit how you live before we got into this talk. And do you have a form of like time management? How do you structure your day, or do you have certain routines to compose?
Yeah, you know, the thing is, I mean, I've been writing for so long that I write every day. I mean, I write every day. I always have, obviously, I'm fortunate that I have a project, multiple projects that I have to work on every day. But I would write anyway, because I feel very untethered if I'm not writing something. And so it's the best part of my day, really. My time management is, can I get everything else done and out of the way in time to be left alone long enough to write something? I do think it's worthwhile to write every day. As you and I talked about before we started, I wherever I am, I stay on a European clock. So if I'm in the States, I write through the night. We started at 4 a.m. for me, this podcast. And that's the middle of my workday, really. And I will write. And I usually write till 6 or 7 a.m. and then I'll sleep for 4 or 5 hours and get up. And if I have nothing else to do, I go right back to work. There's nothing I would rather do, really, than write, or maybe watch hockey. They're a pretty close second. But so that's it. That my, you know, people talk about having the discipline to write. Well, the discipline for me is I need the discipline to make sure I do the other stuff. I don't, you know, pay the bills, buy the food, you know, I eat. I don't need any discipline to write. I because I love it. And it's the one time every day where I'm the happiest. So, and I think that's a sign, you know, if you ever wonder whether or not you chose the right path, just do a little check of how you feel when you're doing the work. And if you're happy, you picked right. And I there's nothing I like better than writing. So I definitely, I'm on the right path. Wherever it leads, I am on the right path.
And so obviously the ideas come easily to you?
No. Sometimes they do. Sometimes they do. I do think that there's a, you know, it's a bit like exercising any other muscle, if you do it every day, the ideas come easier. I think that's another reason to write every day, because if you just sit around waiting to be struck by lightning, you're probably not going to get much done. So the ideas, boy, you know, again, there's 12 notes. I mean, you do realize the limitations, you know, when you're sitting at the piano or you're looking at a computer screen and you realize these are the same 12 notes I had 10 years ago. They're the same 12 notes I'll have 10 years from now. So there's a sort of fatalism in that, you know, these are the one, this is what I have to, at least in the Western system of tuning, this is what I have to work with. And so the ideas come and sometimes they don't. And sometimes, you know, I always say the times when I get a chance to talk to students, I always say, you know, if a carpenter is making a chair, right, he doesn't wake up every morning and say, I wonder what the chair looks like today. Well, it's pretty much going to look like the chair looked like yesterday, right? There's going to be four legs. And music is a bit like that. You have to realize there's a certain architecture that is endemic to all music. And so rather than perpetually trying to reinvent the wheel, which can be crippling, you sort of have to accept the limitations that are inherent in the music that we have. And when you do that, you know, there's a strange freedom in giving up your soul to that and realizing that this is how the music is. And for me anyway, it's kind of a Zen thing, but I welcome the restrictions. They're sort of liberating. And in that way, the ideas come easier.
Well, that's very interesting to talk about it in this way, that there are limitations. I think none of my guests have done that before. And I also feel that sometimes limitation is a gift, but mm-hmm. for me, and that's how I found out that I'm a singer and I probably will never be a composer. I always thought if I would compose or try to compose, I would not be able to decide, because I would see there are too many options. And being a singer, I feel so lucky that I can sing different music, different styles and everything. Yeah. And it's like putting a different dress on every time, and I totally enjoy it. But I think that was the point when I realized I really am a singer.
Well, I understand exactly what you mean. And it's funny you say that, because I feel a bit like I put on a different set of clothing depending on what I'm writing. You know, I mean, if I'm working with Shakespeare or if I'm working with Picasso, I have plans for a cello concerto based on a Picasso painting. And, you know, I'm writing a song cycle in French now with Paul Edouard, the French surrealist poet. And all of those things feel like different colors, different flavors, different costumes in a way. But, you know, of course, the key is that it all has to be me. And so, I briefly studied acting in college, and mm-hmm. I had a wonderful acting teacher. And when students would say they were concerned about expressing themselves, he would always say, who else are you going to express? No matter what you do, you express yourself. You can't help it. You are you. It will come through. And even if you try not to, you're expressing yourself. So in that sense, you know, your personality comes through whether you want it to or not. And that's a good thing. In terms of what you said before, also this fascinating thing about having to choose, right? All these choices, all these options. And really, at the end of the day, my job comes down to choosing, right? Choosing this note over that note, choosing this tempo over that tempo, or this meter, or this instrument, or this register. It is literally a job, which is a series of decisions. And you always have to remember, you know, when you make one decision, you've ruled out 1,000 other decisions. You have to make peace with that. You have to make decisions. You have to. And the key is, pretty much any decision you make is the right one, depending on how the execution plays out. You can make any decision work. And so there's a certain liberty in that, too. You realize that, you know, what you don't want is this sort of paralysis by analysis, this feeling that you can't make a decision. Whatever decision you make, you can make work. Then it becomes a question of technique and craft, really.
And who or what has played the greatest role in shaping you, and what inspires you?
Can we let out the secret that you shared some of these questions with me earlier? And I looked at that one and I thought, I hope you don't ask me that one. I wouldn't know where to begin. It's such a hard question. Everything. You know, I grew up in a really supportive environment of family. I was always told that I could do anything. I was net, you know, whatever ridiculous idea I had, it was always encouraged. It never crossed my mind once that there was something I could try that I couldn't do. And I would say that's been the biggest influence on my life, that upbringing, that realization, this sort of instilled in me this belief that I could do anything anybody else could do and probably some things no one else could do. And I sort of have held that. Sometimes, you know, it feels like when you're an artist, you need a sort of irrational self-belief. And because the odds are against all of us. I mean, you know that. Surely anyone with any sense knows the odds are against you. But I don't care. I really don't care. And so I've been lucky. And I would say the thing that the biggest influence on me as a person, not just as a composer, was being gifted that self-confidence, that self-belief. When I became interested in opera, I was probably 17, 18 years old. And I came home one day and my dad had started studying Italian privately so that he could understand what I was singing. I mean, on his own, he got tapes and started to teach himself Italian. I mean, come on, you know, that's how do you top that, really? So I've been very lucky in that way.
Yeah, it's amazing because we both know that there are many people who have to work the way back to get to this, that everything is possible. And yeah, that's a different road. And what does success mean for you?
In a really practical sense, it means not having to do anything other than write, being able to make a living as a composer. It's not easy, but the ability to wake up every day and be able to write music that people will perform and knowing they'll perform it too. You know, as you said, I'm really lucky because stuff gets played all over the world and really top ensembles and orchestras and recordings and all that stuff. But the truth is, for me, success, I always thought, you know, I would feel successful if I could spend whatever time I have on the earth the way I wanted to spend it, right? And not having to sell it to someone else for a minimum wage, being able to live by my own efforts and being able to do what I wanted to do, which was write music, write classical music. And so in that sense, you know, I sort of feel like I'm playing with house money now. Whatever happens now, I feel like I kind of won the game because I've been able to live the way I wanted to live. I've been able to choose my path. And that's also just a ridiculous blessing.
Awesome. And is there anything that drives you forward or do you have a vision?
I'm really competitive. So I want to be at the top of everything all the time. And I like that. I also grew up playing lots of sports. I like to win things. And you don't really want, you know, what's winning in the arts. But I mean, what drives me is I want the next piece to be better than the one before. I want it to be played 100 times. I want it to be heard everywhere. I want it to be recorded. I mean, I wake up every day on a mission to spread my own brand, my own works. And that really does drive me. I'm really, really like hyper competitive. And
okay.
I mean, it's true. I don't know, probably not fashionable to say that, but it is absolutely true. I mean, and it doesn't mean competitive necessarily with other people, but it means really competitive with the other versions of myself, even, you know, that I just drive myself to be better every day, to not to be complacent, to keep working. And you know, I'm starting a couple of, I think we can say by March, we should be able to say this. I have a couple of commissions from Symphony Orchestra Basel for 20, I don't even know, 27, 28, it might be, I'm not sure. And I'll start those. They're two pieces, two orchestra pieces. I'll probably start them probably around the time that Titus premieres. I'll have the time to get to them. And I'm already thinking, I really want them to be new. I want them to be different from the stuff I've written before. I don't want to fall into the same patterns. I want to find new patterns. And so in that sense, for me, that's sort of a sign of being competitive. I want those pieces to be better than anything I've written before. I don't want to just write the same thing over and over and over.
And when I hear that you are writing so many pieces, and I mean also big pieces, I mean an orchestra piece You need some time, and with all the voices and all that, are you then making like plan that you know, okay, I have to write this piece the next whatever 3 months and this then, or
Yes.
are you more kind of a flow person? You just feel it when you should, or you just work on one piece, or can you
Well, at
switch
the
or?
moment, right now, I'm writing two pieces sort of side by side. This song cycle that'll be recorded in the UK probably later this year with some other song cycles of mine on a disc of my art songs. And I'm also writing a saxophone sonata inspired by the artist Paul Klee. So I'm writing those two sort of side by side. So I'll write a movement of one, I'll write a couple of songs, and I'll switch over and write a movement. However, the mood strikes. If you have an idea for one thing, you sort of go with it. When you're finished, you kind of click back to the other thing. Generally speaking, if I'm writing a really big orchestra piece, that's the only thing I'll work on because it really does take your full concentration. But there are times, and this will sound incredibly mechanical, but there are times when I literally determine how many bars I need to write per day to meet a deadline. I mean, let's be honest. This is professional work. There's a deadline. These all have deadlines. And again, you can't sit around hoping, that a miracle will happen. You have to, get the hammer and nails out and get to work. And so I literally will sometimes calculate how many bars I have to write in the morning, how many bars I have to write in the afternoon. And there's no other way to, for me anyway, there's no other way to meet a deadline. You can't miss it. That's another little tidbit for anybody out there. Don't miss your deadlines.
Yeah, I think that this is also so important what you say. I mean, everyone, whether you're a composer or interpreter, you have to know how your workflow is or your speed. I mean, I also know a composer, she says, I can only write two pieces a year. And so she's booked ahead of years because people like her work, but she says she's very slow. And to know what your mechanism is very important, and to kind of have this overview. I mean, I do that too, especially when there are different projects kind of running parallel. Or right now, I don't have to learn that much new repertoire because some things are repetition right now. But then I also ask people for the concerts, whatever, in June and October. I'm like, if there's any music you already have, give it to me because I like to learn it as early as possible, because I know there are also times, when I'm also just stuck in rehearsals, I cannot learn a new piece or so, or I can't. And I also need some time. I mean, I don't have perfect pitch. I mean, you have been singing, so I need to kind of program my body. And so I think those things are so important, because if you don't know yourself, you miss a deadline, and then people are disappointed, and that's not professional. And I also remember it was years ago, someone asked me for a concert, and the thing was, I had time the day of the concert, but all the other days were packed with rehearsing for other big projects. So I had to turn it down. I'm like, I cannot do this if you cannot rehearse. And this is also, I have the feeling I know when there is really like I reach the edge, when I'm like, okay, this is now kind of exciting. I hope I get through it. And I don't want to do it all the time, but I also know if I would go over the edge, then everything falls apart like cards. And so
Absolutely.
far I've never gone over, but I have been sometimes very tied to what is possible for me.
Absolutely. And I think the other thing for singers is you are your instrument and you have to take care of that. You can't probably sing 10 hours a day. You can't, if you're a pianist, you can be at the keyboard all day long. You can't do that to your voice. And so you really have to have a different way, at least I did have a different way of learning music because you can't pound away. You just can't, or I couldn't anyway.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah. And well, I'm enjoying talking to you, and I will also look up at
I'm
if I
enjoying
can
talking
come
to you.
if I can come in March to your concert and to your premiere of
Please
Titus.
come.
Yes, I have to see.
Yes.
If my
Please.
calendar is free, I will come. But I have one last question for you, and that is, which tip would you like to give young artists?
Oh boy. It could be a very philosophical, metaphysical tip about tuning into the, you know, vibrations of the earth. But really, the truth is, I was given two great pieces of advice at university from composition teachers, and they seem really simple, and maybe self-evident, but I'm going to share them because they've really served me well. When you are doing this for a living, make sure that the idea that you start with is the one that you wanted, because there is very little chance to go back and start over. That was the first piece. And the second piece of advice, and this sounds harsh, but it's absolutely true. Amateurs start pieces, professionals finish them. It is so easy to start a piece, run into a roadblock, wander off and start another one. Run into a roadblock and wander off and start another one. Finish the piece. Get to the double bar. I know this is really practical, you know, hammer and nails kind of advice, but it is so true. You must finish your pieces. And there's a great satisfaction in drawing that double bar or hitting the little computer button, whatever. And you have to do that. And so my advice is start good and finish good, because there's those two things will define you as a composer for sure.
Oh, great advice. Thank you, Jeffrey. And thank you for talking to me. And I hope I see you soon then.
Thank you, Irina. I love talking with you. And I look forward to seeing you at the concert.
This was the interview from today. I hope that it inspired you. And please send me your emails, send me your feedback, because I love to interact with you. Thank you very much that you tuned in with me today. I really, really hope that you liked it. And please tell your friends and colleagues about this podcast. I thank you very much. I wish you all the best. Live your music, live your life, and see you next time. Yours, Irina.